Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures into everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. Today, we have a very special guest, attorney John Mitchell, a partner in the Taft Law Firm in Cleveland, Ohio. John is a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers, a group that is restricted to the top 1% of lawyers in the state. He also has won many other top awards for his trial work. We're going to talk with him about his nationally acclaimed specialty, which is defending people charged with white-collar crime. First of all, John, welcome.
Thank you. I hope my mom tunes in to hear that introduction.
Well, we'll hope that it's substantiated through our conversation.
We'll tag her on the socials.
There you go.
Judge Gail, you and I chatted yesterday, and you've got an opening question for John, and then we're just going to sort of have a conversation. As long as we don't talk over each other so the listeners can understand what we're doing, Judge Gail, you get first crack at it.
Absolutely. I'd like to also welcome you, John, to the podcast. And I am absolutely enamored with the work that you do in the area of white collar crime. But I also understand, for the benefit of our listeners, we kind of use these words in our profession, having a sense of understanding. But for the benefit of our listeners, can you kind of define for us what a white collar crime is, especially in comparison to other types of crimes?
Sure, Judge. Well, again, thanks to both of you for having me on. This is my first podcast experience, and frankly, it's very exciting. Look, generally, the white-collar criminal practice encompasses three distinct areas. The first are what are called compliance initiatives. And many industries, such as healthcare, securities, government contracting companies, construction companies, are heavily regulated. And they require compliance with federal regulations. As part of that, what our firm does and what our lawyers do a lot of times are drafting compliance initiatives that address like training and corporate policies. They institute internal controls to ensure the company is acting appropriately and in compliance with federal and state, in compliance with its federal and state regulatory framework. If you're ever truly bored, you can crack open the DOJ Justice Manual, which is the Bible of federal prosecutors, and you'll see that with regards to companies facing adverse government scrutiny, the DOJ Manual and the sentencing guidelines as well place great emphasis on a company's compliance with its regulatory framework and with state and federal laws. And whenever a company is facing an adverse encounter with the government, the strength and vibrancy, the robustness of its compliance program is also the most important component to extricating the company from its headache. So we spend a lot of time putting those compliance initiatives together. We work with companies and other lawyers and general counsels and so forth to make sure that the company is operating lawfully and appropriately and in an ethical manner. The second large component of my practice is something that harkens back to my days when I was in law enforcement, and those are called internal investigations. From time to time, companies may discover that their employees have done something illegally in order to obtain work. For example, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act prohibits the paying of bribes overseas to secure work for companies. Well, under the current administration, there's been a freeze in those prosecutions, but the statutes of limitation haven't run. So, you know, that is a key component. And we get hired to ferret out wrongdoing with regards to the actions of a corporation's employees or a company's employees. For example, you may have other employees that are selling the company's intellectual property or trade secrets. You have situations, and Judge Gail, I know you're aware of the massive county corruption scandal that took place about a decade ago here in Cuyahoga County.
Oh, yeah.
You have situations where individuals are paying bribes to secure government work. You have situations where a company or its employees may have discharged oil or chemicals in an illegal manner. And it's just so broad, the gamut of this stuff, but you can have situations where a plant is, when they're emitting chemicals into the air may exceed permissible limits, or hacking situations, right, where a company comes in and finds out that their computer system and their data and their intellectual property has been stolen by a competitor or foreign actor. So the internal investigations had really boils down to our lawyers at the firm being engaged by a company to kind of ferret out any potentially illegal behavior that their employees have been engaged in or that someone has done towards that company. And then we interact with federal and state prosecutors to navigate the company through those situations. And then really the most common, what I'll call white collar type of facet is what we see on TV, right? White collar crimes. And that is the defense of corporations and individuals in, for example, financial crimes, where you have mail fraud, wire fraud, honest services fraud. In the healthcare arena, there are anti-kickback regulations. We talked about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act or environmental cases, antitrust cases. It's really a limitless list of potential areas that will be brought in to defend either a corporation. Harkening back to the public corruption discussion we just had, I mean, you have bribery cases where people are paying bribes. You have self-dealing cases where, or honest services cases where a public official may be receiving compensation inappropriately and in violation of their ethical duties to the governmental entity that they serve. We see situations involving conflicts of interest or tax offenses. And look, to kind of the most common thing we see are conspiracy cases where the government doesn't have to really prove the underlying offense, but instead they only have to prove the agreement or that somebody was participating in an agreement to do some illegal activity. And of concern to me, and I know my fellow colleagues at the firm, we've seen an uptake in the use of RICO cases in the white collar arena. I mean, the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act was passed and enacted in the mid 70s to chase down and smash organized crime. And it was used very effectively to do so. But now we're seeing that same statute being used in the white collar gamut with significant draconian penalties. And that's a concern to us. So we see a rise of those types of cases. But generally, I mean, the White Collar Criminal Act, the White Collar Criminal case really involves defending a corporation or an individual facing what I like to call unwanted government scrutiny and navigating them through that system. These cases involve a significant interaction with the federal government, usually. And that's much different than what we think of typical, what I'll call law and order cases that you see on TV, where they're crimes of violence or drug-related offenses. White-collar criminal cases, interestingly enough, are more akin to civil cases than anything else in the criminal world, because you have to have an understanding of how companies work, what employees are tasked with doing and what their job duties and responsibilities are, the regulations that are unique to a particular industry or situation. And for lack of a better phrase, sometimes we call them thinking man's crimes, you know, rather than crimes of passion. So those are kind of the three general areas that we deal with on a daily basis. And that's kind of a broad and general introduction to what constitutes white collar crimes.
So let me jump in here and just summarize. The three areas would be compliance, which is prevention. You're looking at how to prevent legal difficulties. You're looking at internal investigations to get ahead of perhaps criminal legal difficulties. And then the final segment would be, if there is criminal action, then working with the government as well as your client, be it an individual or a corporation, to try to navigate through those criminal charges. Is that correct?
Yeah, Tom, that's a very good summary. The only slight nuance I would make is in the internal investigations realm, sometimes what happens is, you know, the corporation will say, hey, we'll receive a letter or notice or contact from the FBI, and then they'll realize they have a problem, and then they've got to get ahead of the problem. So you're investigating, but more often, well, I should say oftentimes, the internal investigation is spurred by a contact from an investigating agency.
You said that the situation as a defense attorney is different than your run-of-the-mill criminal defense, which I did for a number of years besides being on the bench. But one common area is being able to communicate with a jury. These seemed like they're highly complex cases. Do you have difficulty breaking them down to smaller bites the juries can understand?
That is a challenge. That is a challenge. I'll tell you, it's been my experience in the vast majority of cases I handled, either as a prosecutor or defense attorney. And frankly, it's very reassuring that juries, in my experience, tend to take these things very seriously, right? They give it the attention they deserve. Nobody likes to be called for jury service.
Except me. I did the happy dance when I got my subpoena.
All right. Fair enough.
I think I'm one of you.
All right. Almost everybody doesn't like being called for jury service, but they take it serious. But you hit the nail on the head. I mean, they are complicated cases. Oftentimes there are multiple experts and, you know, being able to translate what you're trying to prove to a jury can be more of a challenge, because in these cases, you know, if you watch Law and Order or the many cases that I would consider to be more violent cases, oftentimes the question is, who did this, right? If you think of a murder case, more often than not, the defense is,
right,
you know, it wasn't me, or oftentimes it's, well, it was me, but I was acting in self-defense, right?
Right.
But when you have the question of who is it, that's a little different than what you experience in a white-collar case. Because in a white-collar case, the question is often, what was the intent behind the action, right? Because if you take a standard wire fraud case, I mean, there's really no question that the money went from point A to point B. I mean, the emails or the texts say what they say. It's not so much a question of what happened. It really pivots to, why did it happen? And was the person acting with the intent to break the law? And so translating that and presenting that to a jury and having experts come in and say, hey, this is what this really means in this federal governmental contracting space, and this is how contracts really operate. I mean, they become very complicated very quickly. So, but again, our job as lawyers is to be able to translate that to a jury. And the best advice that I've always followed is, if you can't explain something to somebody in 30 seconds, you better figure out a way to get your client out of that.
Especially with attention spans being between 8 and 40 seconds, according to the latest studies.
Yeah, that doesn't help for long, boring, dry cases where telephone records and bank records and emails and recordings are played. It can really tax a juror.
Well, can I jump in and ask just super quick though? It sounds like what you're saying, John, is that there are highly complex contours to white collar crimes. And so when you're dealing with those as the attorney, do you sometimes find it difficult yourself to understand that? Because I suspect, and in my experience, even when I handled cases, if I couldn't understand something, it really became difficult to convey that even simply to lay individuals who were on juries, and I knew they had no frame of reference, or they had very limited frame of reference. So is that a challenge, and how do you overcome that?
It is a challenge. I mean, because you become an expert. I mean, I tell people with some degree of truth, my brain is like a bathtub, right? It fills up with this knowledge of a particular case. The case ends, I pull the plug, and it goes down the tube. Now, every now and again, if I'm playing Trivial Pursuit or something else, some archaic fact that I learned in a particular matter may surface, and that helps me in that moment.
Well, you're trying out for Jeopardy.
Yeah, when I'm trying out for Jeopardy, right. Right. But no, for example, years ago, I handled an environmental case involving allegations that my client had dumped oil into Lake Superior. And I had to become an expert on how oil interacts in water, what it looks like, the testing involved, the processes to prove that. I had to become an expert in how an engine room in a tugboat operates and the equipment that's used there. And, you know, if you ask me about that today, I couldn't answer any of those questions. But at the time, I was a quasi-expert. So you have to immerse yourself in the particular industry, in the particular governmental framework, to make sure that you have as much or more knowledge than the government's lawyers. So yes, it's a challenge.
If we could get into the trial process a little bit in that aspect, one of the big things that we've talked about on this program, as well as others, is selection of juries and how important that is. I would imagine in this kind of case, a white collar case, selection of a jury is vital. And do you have a standard of the kind of person that you're looking for? I know you probably did as a prosecutor, but do you have a similar standard of the kind of person you look for in a juror?
So I'm going to back up a couple steps here and just talk about some challenges in general with voir dire.
Yeah.
So, for example,
gosh, your timing's perfect. We just did an episode on voir dire.
Oh, great.
Go ahead.
So in the on the state side, when you try cases, you it's been my experience, you get a lot of flexibility on voir dire, and you have the ability to stand up and question jurors and meet with them and talk to them and explore maybe their preconceived biases or their experiences in their lives that would either qualify or disqualify them as a juror, right? On the federal system, it can be radically different. And at certain times, I've been in cases where the judge does the entire voir dire and doesn't allow any of the juror or any of the lawyers to do any of the questioning. And at that point, it doesn't really become a question of jury selection. It's more a question of deselection.
Right.
And you're trying to figure out, I mean, and it's scary, right? Because at times you'll end up with jurors that haven't said a word, right? The only thing they've done is indicate that whatever they were asked, you know, whatever conditions the court put on their participation in the trial, then they didn't raise their hand and say, well, yeah, I feel this way or I can't do that, right? And it can be unnerving. And so when on the federal side, I'm a big believer in jury questionnaires. I try to push for the ability to question the jurors. I've had varying degrees of success there. And, you know, sometimes I'll say, I hear you, Mr. Mitchell, I'll give you half an hour.
To that point, which is better than none, right? Right. And to that point, I think also you kind of lose the opportunity to do just a little bit of rapport building.
Correct.
Your potential jurors, right?
Correct. And the first time they hear you, other than when you introduce yourself at the beginning of the case, is when you stand up and give an opening statement. And there's a lot of statistics out there that show that jurors, like most human beings, make up their minds very quickly. And if it can be a long, hard slog to move the needle towards not guilty, if if the government comes out strong on an opening statement, right? So, yeah, I think voir dire, and this is me on a soapbox here for a moment, is the most important part of trial practice. You know, I mean, you can have the best or worst presentation. You can be brilliant. You can be terrible, but the effectiveness of your case is going to be determined by the people who are hearing your message. And if they're sympathetic to that message, you're going to win. And if they're not, or they've had life experiences that contradict what you're trying to pitch to them, you're not. I mean, and when I've lectured on voir dire, I always put up a slide that has 12 jurors with a face imposed over it. And I said that the face imposed over it is my dad, right? I mean, if I make a pitch to my dad, he's going to be receptive and he's going to want to hear it. And then the second slide I show is a jury with faces from television law shows, like, you know,
yeah,
pick one. And I say, now imagine trying to sell you're not guilty to Sam McCoy from Law and Order, right? I mean,
you
until the cows come home and you're going to go home hoarse with a guilty verdict, right? So it's a real challenge. And so to circle back to where I'm at, I mean, if you've got complicated accounting principles that are going to be at issue in the case, it may help to have an accountant on there, right, who can educate the jury. If you've got a securities case, right, you're defending, I mean, having somebody on there who understands what the SEC does and kind of what you can and can't do may be an aid. It may be a problem too, right, if you've got somebody who was playing a little fast and loose with the regulations. But I don't like to use the word educated because I don't think that translates into necessarily a better juror. What I look for, I've got a couple rules. I try to look for people I believe who are generally going to give the case the attention it deserves. I try to look for people who are leaders or strongly principled, knowing that if you're back in the room and it's 11-1, I can count on that person to say, guys, you can talk all day, but I'm not gonna change my vote, right? And I try to look for people, and I jokingly say I never kick off a juror who wears a tie, because to me or dresses appropriately for the situation, because to me that shows a respect for the system, and that they take their obligation as a juror serious. So that kind of third category for me would be serious, respectful people, right?
As opposed to the person sitting there with a Born to Raise Hell t-shirt, right?
Well and a bonnet. the best story I can tell along that is I tried a case, it wasn't a white collar case, years ago, and we picked the jury and I liked the jury. I was a prosecutor, and the next day one of the jurors showed up with a t-shirt on that said, "You have the right to remain dead." And it had a big handgun on it. And I remember looking up the defense lawyer saying, "Well, there's one. I got one." You know? and that person was convicted. But yeah, it's not a science. It's an art. And it's really, and my one hard and fast rule of jury selection is if I get a bad feeling about somebody, I kick them off. And it could be for ridiculous reasons, but if I have a bad feeling in my gut that I don't like that person, the chances are they probably feel the same way about me, and whatever I'm going to say isn't going to change their mind, so I boot them off.
If I could jump in with one other jury question, then I'll turn it over to you, Judge Gale, but to follow up on this, you know, defense attorneys sometimes you're always going for a not guilty a verdict, but that has to be unanimous. And sometimes you're going for a hung jury, as a backup position. In a white collar case that's so complicated, and some of these cases take so long to trial, is a hung jury a win?
I think it is. I do in a white collar case for two reasons. One, more than two reasons, but. The first reason is now you've seen the government's best shot, right? And you know what's coming. You know how they view the evidence. You know you know where they're going to go the second time, right? Because it's rare that they suddenly discover new evidence that's going to suddenly turn everything. So that's number one. And with that, I mean, your client, you know, gets to go home and live to fight another day, right? Another reason is that, you know, the federal government won't indict a case unless they believe they're going to win. And so, you know, there becomes a real look in the mirror moment for the AUSA handling the case, because what they assumed was a case that they would win. Suddenly, you know, 12 people have told them that they're looking at the world a little differently. And look, the federal government wins something like 95% of all cases they try, and they get pleas in like over 90% of all cases they indict. So, you know, so when you beat the federal government or you hang a jury, that's a big deal, because that's not what they're expecting to happen. And it's a real look in the mirror moment for the AUSA.
And it's interesting you mentioned the stats for the federal government, because I suspect part of the reason why their success rates are as high as they are is because of the amount of resources that are available to them pre-indictment, meaning they've got a vast amount of resources to investigate cases and to essentially put the case together before it's even indicted, such that they can, you know, almost assuredly predict the outcome of the case. With that in mind, how does that compare to what maybe you or your firm needs to do to prepare or to defend a client against the weight of all of that?
Well, that is a very astute comment, because look, you know, by the time, in my experience, by the time most AUSAs is presented to a case to the grand jury, they've already got their trial exhibits marked, right? I mean, they know what they're going to do. So I'm going to kind of pivot here and talk a little bit about the difference between state and federal cases, and then come back, Judge Gale.
And talk about the days of being a recovering prosecutor.
Yeah, I've recovered. It took a while, but I've recovered. Look, typically on the state side, you know, at least in a large county like Cuyahoga County, you know, they've got a grand jury unit. Those folks come in and they present cases all day long. And then somebody's sitting at home one day and they open up their mail and they've been indicted, right? And they come down and the process starts. Or you know, there was a shooting, somebody got arrested, and there's an indictment returned a short time later. And the case, I mean, it's a complete trial posture, right, from day one. And the decision's going to be, look, am I going to plea this thing or are we going to try it? The federal system is significantly different, right? I mean, the government will start investigating when they get word of a potential illegality. You know, somebody makes a report to the FBI. They read something in the paper. And they'll issue subpoenas or execute search warrants. You know, as somebody who's handled numerous subpoenas for clients that receive them, a lot of time is spent negotiating the scope of that subpoena, right? I mean, the government say, we want all documents related to X. And then you call them back and say, you know, what do you really want? Because if we go view all documents related to X, it's going to be X, Y, and Z, and it's going to be massive amounts of data. And they say, well, hey, could we use these search terms, and can you search, you know, text messages and emails and come back and give us this stuff? And that can take months, right? And you know, if there's a search warrant executed, oftentimes the first call is, I need my computers back because the company can't operate. And, you know, we got 250 people who are sitting around here not knowing what to do. You know, we've got obligations to our customers. We need the computers back. And you know, generally, it's been my experience that most AUSAs are receptive to that. I mean, they'll move expeditiously to forensically clone the materials they seized, and they'll give them back to you, and then the company can go on and get back to work, right? And then, you know, so the federal government, is digesting this massive amount of material. And it can take months, and sometimes it can take years. And then there'll come a point in time where, you know, you've introduced yourself to the AUSA and you've negotiated the scope of the subpoena. You've worked to get the company's property back. And, you know, you start talking about what's the framework of really what they're investigating, what they're looking at, and how do you start to extricate your client from this mess, right? And the interesting dynamic that's so different than the state cases are, look, in the state side, the indictment arrives in the mail. You know, the defense attorney moves for his discovery, you know, looks at that, starts filing pretrial motions like motions to suppress. And this is all in a truncated period where presumably there's a trial date that's no more than maybe 3 months if they're in jail because of speedy trial concerns, or 270 days if they're out. And, you know, there are continuances and things like that. But most state cases, I would think the vast majority of them get resolved in under a year. And it may be on the federal side over a year before you're even talking to someone.
Wow.
And so, you know, and then you go back and forth kind of deciding if you can negotiate a resolution. And if you can, and what I tell people, a lot of the work on the white collar side is done long before anybody sets foot in a courtroom. And, you know, if you're able to resolve the case with the federal prosecutors, then you'll file what's called an information, which is an agreed upon set of charges that a company or an individual will plead guilty to, or maybe with the regards to a company, you'll go through a deferred prosecution or a non-prosecution agreement, which sets conditions that the company has to satisfy before they drop the charges or agree not to bring the charges, right? And so in some cases, almost all the work is done before anybody is charged or not charged, right? And if you're representing an individual and they're going to plead guilty and they're going to proceed through an information, then you have to negotiate a plea agreement. And you know, this can take months. So, I mean, the whole point here is that it's a radically different legal process on the federal side because so much work is done before any document is ever filed in a court, right? It is rare where the federal government will just go out, arrest somebody, and file a criminal complaint and then indict them shortly thereafter. It happens, but it is much more common for us to engage in this kind of interaction that I've described previously, where you end up negotiating a resolution for either the company or the individual.
So, John, if a white-collar crime goes to court in the federal system, can the observer, the casual observer, say, you know, this is a rare moment, and really, people, this must be something where they're really at loggerheads. They can't decide, you know, today's Friday. Yeah.
No. Well, no. That's a fair analysis, right? I've been in meetings with the AUSAs where they sit down and they'll play various tapes and they'll say, "See what this means X," and I'm listening, saying, "I don't hear that. I don't hear that." And really, what comes down to it is, you know, they've got a view of the world and it doesn't match my view of the world, and it's up to a jury to decide that. And you know, look, cases get tried for a variety of reasons, right? I mean, they get tried because you can't resolve the case. Either the client says, "Look, I didn't do this. I'm not going to plead to it." The government wants to indict on charges that you don't think are applicable, or you just have this difference of opinion that's not going to be resolved between the two legal professionals, and it's going to be up to a group of 12 to decide. Or you have situations, and I had this one time where we tried a case, and you know, I thought the key to our resolution was, and look, the client was convicted, but he ended up being sentenced to a lighter sentence than he would have gotten if he would have pled, and it was because, look, the government was pitching a narrative that we didn't think was supportable, and when the judge who sentenced the client heard one of the government's witnesses testify, it was pretty clear to everybody in the room that whatever my client had done, this wasn't really the bad guy. The bad guy was the one who was cooperating with the federal government. And it was a much easier pitch at sentencing time to come in and say, "Look, Your Honor, you heard the trial. You heard who the real villain here is. You know, regardless of what my client did, it's certainly not worthy of a sentence that the government is seeking." And we were successful in that regard. And so, I mean, cases get tried for different reasons. And of course, you have the ones where, you know, the client says, "Look, I didn't do this, period." And you go and you try that and you either win or you lose.
Are those situations more infrequent or rarer in white-collar cases than in the street crime?
The thing that disappoints me today most about being a lawyer is the disappearance of the Great American Trial. I think our legal system is better if cases are tried, right? I just do. But we could talk about that on a completely different podcast. But I would answer your question this way, is any time a case gets tried on the federal side, I think I wouldn't call it a rare event, but I would call it an uncommon event. The chances of trying a state criminal case are significantly higher. It's just because of the reasons and the negotiations and the things I talked about previously in the podcast. It is extremely rare for a federal white collar case to go to trial. I mean, with the resources the government has, I mean, they can pour through the text, they can pour through the emails. I mean, they may have cooperating witnesses who are going to come in and corroborate their version of the events. They may have, you know, surreptitious recordings of the client on a phone call with somebody else where they're, you know, explaining in very clear detail exactly how they're going to break the law. And so it is, I think the disappearance of the Great American Trial, and there's statistics all over about the place about this, is really, I think, an impediment to the justice system.
And John, it sounds like that's the case, meaning the, you know, the waning or the disappearance of the trial as we know it, even in a structure where you said more than the act itself is the intent that matters. And so that opportunity to kind of get the evidence and the exhibits and the information in front of the jury to explain intent, which seems to be, you know, more often than not the linchpin in white collar cases, seems to be something that's also disappearing. Is that what I'm hearing?
Kind of. I mean, look, in white collar cases, it's not unusual for defendants to testify, right? Because, look, I mean, if you pull 85 emails and the question is, what did the person mean behind these emails? I mean, I can get up and cross examine all day long. Well, couldn't this mean this? Couldn't this mean this? Couldn't this mean this? But it's not uncommon for the defendant to take the stand and say, look, this is what I was trying to accomplish. This is what I was doing. This is what I meant to do. And look, the unintended bent or the unintended problem with those types of situations are in a white collar case or whenever a defendant testifies, the case becomes less about whether the government proved his case beyond a reasonable doubt. And it more becomes, who did you believe, right? And so that can be a real challenge when defending these cases. It's whether or not you're going to put the client on the stand and let them explain what they were trying to accomplish, because oftentimes there's no other way to do it, right? And so, but the disappearance of the Great American Trial, and look, it's not just a byproduct of, you know, an unwillingness of people to try cases. It's not. I mean, look, my highest and best use is being in trial. I know most prosecutors love trying cases on the state and federal side. I'm not sure the judges love it as much as everybody else does, but I'll let you two weigh in on that.
No.
Yeah.
It all depends. It all depends.
Right.
I'm always game for a good story.
Okay, good. Good to know. But look, think about this. And this is when you're representing an individual. I mean, these are expensive cases, right? And very few people have the resources to defend a white collar case properly, right? To give you an example, I had a case where the government provided me 4 terabytes of data. Now, I didn't know what a terabyte was before I got the case, but that's a number with 12 zeros after it. Right.
Wow. Listen up, folks, a number with 12 zeros. We just learned something today.
Yeah. So, and there was a famous case out of New York, and I can't remember the defendant's name, where, you know, the government had provided so much data that to print, not review, to print that information would have cost $150,000. Right. And so if you've got that much data, what do you need to defend it? Well, first you need a lot of lawyers and paralegals and document reviewers, right? That's not inexpensive. Because many of these are intent-based crimes and involve what can be kind of vague or nebulous statutes, there's a lot of pretrial motion practice, and they get very expensive very quickly. And You know, sometimes you need experts. We talked about that. You need sophisticated defense counsel, you know, and they can be very expensive for the average individual to defend. So, you know, that is a real challenge. And, you know, on the corporate side, sometimes it doesn't get much better. I mean, people think of corporations as these massive monoliths, but look, in terms of companies, you have, you know, you're going to have your general counsel or someone in the legal department work full time on this. You know, it's incredibly distracting from the business of what you're trying to accomplish. And you know, you're constantly producing massive amounts of materials to the government. And it's not unusual for them to come back and say, we want more, we want more, we want more, we want more. What have you done to run down this? You know, and then you're off on going in places you never thought about when the case started and trying to answer questions for the government with the goal of ultimately extracting your client from the mess.
All I hear is cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
If an individual is charged, does the individual bear the burden of the attorney fees, or does the corporation help? How does that work?
It depends, right? And it depends on what role the company or the individual has at the company, right? I mean, a lot of times companies will fire people and cut them off. A lot of times the company will have insurance policies in place for directors and officers that will cover the cost of the prosecution. It really depends on the circumstances and really the company's willingness to step up and back the employee. And look, if you're a corporation, or if you're involved in a corporation or a company owner, this is a free plug to go back and check your insurance policy to make sure you've got the appropriate coverage for a white collar situation.
Well, and along those same lines, if I can ask, what happens if there's the RICO situation, which you indicated earlier, there's an uptick in RICO cases. So, you know, well, let's say, you know, even if there is a policy, what happens if there's a RICO charge? Who gets charged and who becomes the actual defendant?
Well, it depends on the charge and it depends on the case. I think it's rare to see a company embroiled in a RICO indictment unless, you know, the company is really the alter ego of the individual. For example, if I'm John Mitchell and I've got John Mitchell Incorporated, you know, and I'm the sole owner, the sole operator, then that's not unusual, right? But look, if you've got a RICO case and the government's alleging that there's an enterprise and a pattern of corrupt activity, I mean, you can imagine the number of people who are probably going to be embroiled in that. And that becomes very expensive very quickly. And, you know, one of the things we have to be careful of on our side is we have to remind ourselves constantly, who is our client, right? Because if we're engaged on behalf of a company, the company is our client, not the president, not the officers, not the board. It's the company we represent. And that can pose a whole slew of ethical challenges. If we're representing an individual, you know, obviously that individual is our client. And so those are things that you really have to map out at the beginning of the engagement and think strategically so you don't walk yourself into an ethical headache, right? And to circle back, whether it's a RICO or it's a mail fraud charge, if the company doesn't have the appropriate insurance to protect itself or to protect its employees, this gets very quickly, very expensive very quickly.
Or it gets resolved very quickly.
Or it can get resolved very quickly, too.
Well, I was going to ask in that regard, building on what you just said, Gail, is, you know, I'm familiar with slap suits in libel cases, where they're filed knowing that the defendants can't pony up the legal fees to fight them. Mm-hmm. Is there something similar to that in government, or am I suggesting bad faith?
I think you're suggesting bad faith.
Okay.
And Tom, for what it's worth, I mean, the overwhelming majority, I mean, this overwhelming majority of prosecutors I have dealt with on the federal or state side, I thought were true professionals who were trying to do their job in the best way they thought. I really believe that. And the same with the FBI agents and the police officers I've worked with, right? I think I can count on one hand over the 20-some years I've practiced law where I thought that people were doing things for the wrong reason or playing fast and loose with maybe their ethical responsibilities or their professional responsibilities. I mean, I have a lot of respect for the AUSAs that I work with and the FBI agents I work with. They are, for the overwhelming majority, are committed professionals who are trying to do their job the right way. I don't always agree with the decisions they make, but I don't feel that those decisions are made because of some ulterior evil motive against me or my client.
But that trust factor works both ways, too. You work with those people, and they honor the way you work with them. And so that relationship goes both ways.
Well, it does. I mean, and you know, I do civil work. And look, it's not uncommon to have a case with somebody and never see them again, right?
Right.
But in the criminal realm, you're constantly working with the same AUSAs or state prosecutors or the same agents. And look, if they don't trust you, it doesn't matter what you say. And I found that, and it goes both ways, right? I mean, if they lie to me, I'm never going to trust them again either. And I found that you know, people expect you to tell the truth, and they should. And people expect you to fight hard for your clients, which you should. But you can do so in a way where you can leave with a mutual respect and trust that will carry over to the next case, rather than thinking, oh my God, I hope I never find this person again, right? I mean, it's been very rare for me where I've had lawyers that are representing the government that I've had bad experiences with that I wouldn't trust. It is a very rare occurrence.
And I think what's important with what you just said is building those professional relationships, even with those boundaries, is important to keep lines of communication open, because it's very unlikely that you won't cross paths again or that you won't work with that individual again. In fact, it's highly likely that you will. But also, for those who don't engage the legal system often, I think sometimes they come with the perception that the fix is in because of some of those pre-existing relationships and dealings. That if a defense attorney happens to have had some relationship or some knowledge or you know, some ability to access the prosecutor, that must mean that spells doom for, you know, one party or another. And it doesn't necessarily mean that. It actually may work to their benefit. Could you speak to that a little bit? Because I think sometimes our audience, who, you know, isn't always adept of this and doesn't always understand the inner workings of this, they come to it kind of with this skepticism that, you know, we've kind of baked the cake already and everything's already in there and the fix is in. So there's no need to even bother fighting because, you know, everybody's on the team against them.
I can understand that perspective. I don't believe it's accurate. I mean, I believe the cases rise and fall on evidence, right? Because every single lawyer at one time or another with regard to a case is going to have to look themselves in the mirror and say, do I think I can sell 12 people on what I think the result should be, right? I mean, it's that kind of moment where you're looking in the mirror saying, all right, I've got this, and this is what my evidence says. Do I think I can get it across the goal line? So I think most, at least the lawyers I respect, kind of view the world in that prism, right? I mean, I've got a case. Here are my facts. Can I make it? Can I put it together?
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't been embroiled in the criminal justice system, there is a natural skepticism that you just described. And look, it's not unusual for companies to go out and look for counsel that maybe was a former county prosecutor or a former AUSA, under the theory that, well, at least this person will have a relationship with the potential prosecutor on the file. So that kind of swings both ways. But look, I would, if people ask me that question, I would say, look, it's a subset of life, right? I mean, in every single day in our life, we have relationships with people we trust and don't trust.
Indeed.
And the legal system's no different, right? And just because you have a friendship with someone's on the other side, that doesn't mean they're not going to do their job, right? And that may, they can do it nicely, but they can still say, hey, look, John, I would love for you to be the godfather to my newest child, but your client's got to plead to this, right? I mean, and look, I just think from a professional standpoint, at least I've seen on the criminal side, I think there's a collegiality between the bars, or I should say the criminal bar. I mean, and I think if you, you know, tell the truth and you behave as a professional and you don't get personal, I think that will serve your client better in the long run. I that's just been my experience.
I'll tell you, when I was on the bench, I saw more civility, if you will, amongst, you know, defense attorneys and criminal prosecutors. And sometimes I saw on civil cases, and, you know, certainly the stakes are different.
Right? Oh, they're much higher, right? No, they are much higher, but that's this issue of trust. And I agree with that analysis, by the way. I mean, it's tough to send somebody, you know, who it's tough to send a prosecutor some, you know, one of these long drawn out insulting civil letters that go back and forth all the time, knowing that you're going to have to work with that person again, right? And it's also hard for the prosecutor to take a cheap shot at you, knowing that you may end up on the next case. And I think that constant interaction leads to a level of trust that's integral to the operation of our system.
If I could jump in with a question that's not political, but is in the news, and I've got a foot in both camps, one in the law camp and one in the journalism camp, and I'm afraid the journalism folks have not done a very good job explaining this. Just this week, May 12th, the Justice Department came out with what's been deemed a new playbook on white-collar crime enforcement, and following that, the FBI has changed its priorities to do more immigration investigations and allegedly less white-collar cases. Now, where I think the journalists have done a poor job is, you know, explaining what that means. And so, again, not getting into the politics of it, can you explain to our lay audience out there, John, what exactly this means and what they could be looking at here in the next 3 or 4 years?
Sure. Look, when the president of the United States is elected, regardless of party, that president comes in with an agenda, and they prioritize certain areas over others. This administration has made it clear that immigration is going to be a priority, and immigration-related crimes are going to be a priority. So the president gets to select the Attorney General of the United States. The Attorney General of the United States oversees the Department of Justice. And so when a new Attorney General is appointed in, they say, hey, look, this is what the president wants to do. This is where we're going to direct our resources. The federal government has a tremendous amount of resources. However, those resources are not limitless, though it may seem that way. And so you've got X number of AUSAs throughout the United States. You've got X number of FBI and ICE agents and Secret Service and others who can investigate crimes. And when the Department of Justice and the Attorney General set their priorities, those assets are going to be directed to implement those priorities. And that's what we're seeing take place in the current administration. Now, if they prioritize immigration over white-collar enforcement, that may mean less white-collar cases, which, you know, you can feel a chill going up the spine of every white-collar defense lawyer here in the United States, right? But that's how it works. Like, for example, under the Bush administration, you know, after 9/11, what was the priority? It was terrorism, right? So the Department of Justice directed its assets towards bringing terrorism and tracking down and prosecuting people they believed were threats to the United States. So, you know, what you're seeing, I don't think is, it's certainly not unusual. It happens in every administration. You know, they sit down and get their priorities together and decide what they're, where they're going to direct their assets. And that's what's happening today.
With that, though, you know, does that mean that the states sort of follow suit, or do the states say, okay, the feds aren't doing this, we're going to have to beef up our action? Or is this something that's unknown at this point?
I think it's unknown at this point. I you know, I'm going to get back up on my soapbox here for a second. I have been, you know, disappointed by the state level of focus on white collar crime, right? I mean, for example, you know, the federal government won't touch some cases that are under a certain numeric value, right? So for hypothetically, if the victim hasn't lost at least $2 million, the feds aren't interested in prosecuting it because they've got bigger fish to fry, right? Well, that would be a perfect opportunity for the state prosecutors to step in and fill that void. And look, as a citizen, I mean, I've seen firsthand, I mean, financial crimes can be devastating, right? I mean, if you're running a small business and your treasurer embezzles, you know, the employee's retirement plans, if nobody does something about that, then, you know, that money's gone and those people are out, right? I mean, they see their life's work evaporate. So, you know, I've always thought that at least the state's attorneys general and the local prosecutors on the county level or the parish level, if they're in Louisiana, would be well served to make more of a statement in the white collar arena. And in fairness to them, I mean, white collar cases are long, they're complicated, they take a tremendous amount of resources, and today too many local prosecutors are trying to take the levels of violent crime down in their communities, right? But that's just me being on my soapbox.
Well, that's what a podcast is. It's all soapbox heavy, so you are welcome to do that. But I will say to that point, since, you know, this is your wheelhouse and it's your area of expertise, at least since your transition from your days as a prosecutor, does this in any way affect your or can this somehow affect your practice group or the work that's done over at Taft? And what are the other things that you all focus on over there?
Look, I think not just at Taft, but across the nation, there's a concern that white collar cases will become less of a priority, right? And if they're less of a priority, that means that lawyers won't have as much to do. I'm not in the sky is falling camp, right? I mean, I think that the government will always be focused on, and should be always focused on, public corruption cases. And there are always people out there who are trying to take things that don't belong to them. And there are always, you have government actors from, or state actors from other countries that are always trying to steal American technology. And so I'm not in the sky is falling camp. But look, the federal government has deep prioritized FCPA cases, right? And those can be very big, all-encompassing international engagements for law firms, right? And so if those aren't coming along, then suddenly people think, geez, you know, what's the future going to look like in this particular segment of the law? I'm not panicked, because I just have seen from time to time, you know, white collar cases may diminish, but in other places, you know, in other years, they come back stronger. So it's like, I would summarize it, it's similar to a business model, right? Sometimes you have good years, sometimes you have less good years, but that doesn't mean everything's going to
Well, you would still have the compliance aspect. Correct. That you talked about, or the prevention aspect, and also the internal investigation. Yeah. Aspect. Yeah. That still would be ongoing.
Yeah, it is. And the compliance is so key, because, look, what I tell clients is, look, having a vibrant and robust compliance program is another form of insurance for you and your organization, right? I mean, if the worst should ever occur, being able to go into and meet with the AUSA and say, look, whatever happened, it was a rogue actor. Here's all the positive steps we do to train our people the right way. It really sets the tone. I mean, it is the ultimate ounce of prevention, pound of cure, because there's a radically different presentation that takes place when you go in and say, look, we have a vibrant compliance program and this person violated X, Y, and Z. We didn't know what happened. Rather than saying, this person violated X, Y, and Z, and let me tell you about the compliance program we've just instituted, right? It's not the too little.
Oh, the one we're thinking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, right. It's not the too little too late, but you'd certainly, everybody would rather be in the former camp. And so, indeed. Yeah, so, there's always going to be parts. And you know, the cynic in me says that there are always going to be people who break the law. I mean, and so, you know, it's just a question of making sure those people know where they can get quality representation.
John, we want to thank you for giving us your time today. We've been talking with attorney John Mitchell, a partner in the Taft Law Firm in Cleveland, also a fellow in the American College of Trial Lawyers, a winner of top judicial and legal litigation awards for his trial work, especially in the area of white-collar crime. We want to thank you for joining us today.
Indeed, attorney extraordinaire, and we could not be more proud, happy, and honored that you have decided to join us for this important and educational episode of Next Witness, Please. John, thank you so much.
Thanks to both of you. I appreciate your time and the opportunity to discuss this important topic. Thanks.
And Judge Gale, how do people find us?
Well, you can find us anywhere you find your favorite podcast episodes. Next Witness, Please is really proud to be supported and affiliated with NPR, National Public Radio. But you can also find us on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon. And as I said, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. We look forward to you looking out for our next episodes. We release new episodes just about weekly. Our belief is that by tuning in and listening to the education we seek to provide through Next Witness, Please, is that we know people don't trust what they don't understand. And our hope and goal is that you will build your understanding of this legal system inside this democracy, and by extension, you'll learn to trust it more.
And if you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me. You can use my email address, which is hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. And if you have topics you would like for us to cover in the future, shoot us an email and we'll add them to our list. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.